Welcome to Ancient Future Faith with Dr. Chris Alford, pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community in Sacramento. Just what is ancient future Christian faith? Join Chris each week as he talks with special guests about a refreshing renewal in evangelical worship and spirituality that's helping many believers get in touch with their ancient Christian heritage. Now, with another look at how the road to the evangelical future runs through the ancient past, here's Dr. Chris Alford.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome once again to another episode of Ancient Future Faith. My name is Chris Alford. I'm the pastor at Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community right here in Sacramento. And in these Saturday broadcasts on KFIA Radio, we've been taking up the subject of what in the world is ancient future Christian faith. By the way, if you would be interested in learning more about Epiclesis and what in the world Epiclesis means, and a little bit about our community of faith, I'd love for you to pop over to the website. It's epiclesis.org. That's EPICLESIS.org. Today I have a wonderful guest. Her name is Susan Spann. She's a member of our congregation. She's also a lawyer. And one of the principal reasons I wanted her to be here today is that she is a published author, and it's mysteries, and it's kind of hard to describe, Susan, so I'm going to let you do it. Welcome. Glad you're here.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on the show.
I just finished reading your first novel. It's a mystery. I don't want to describe it. I want you to tell the listeners a little bit about this world that you've created, and then I kind of want to pick your brains a little bit about how in the world ancient future Christian faith might intersect with that world.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, my books are titled The Shinobi Mysteries.
Shinobi.
Shinobi is actually the Japanese word for ninja.
Okay.
Which surprises some people. The word ninja is based on a Chinese pronunciation, okay. And those same characters in Japanese are shinobi. My books feature a ninja detective and a Jesuit priest who solve murders in 16th century Kyoto.
What a pair. A ninja detective, mystery solver, and a Jesuit priest.
Indeed. One of the things I really love about the series is that as they go about solving these mysteries, they also are exploring a friendship that's developing between them, and also, of course, the East versus West clash of cultures that was going on.
You said that it was in 16th century Japan. Why did you choose that particular epoch of history to write about?
There were two reasons, really. The first is that the 16th century was the height of the real ninja in Japan. Ninjas were assassins and spies, and they really existed, and they really did serve both as assassins and spies and also as bodyguards. And I thought it would be a very interesting idea to have a ninja detective. But also, this was the period when the Jesuits and the Christian faith were just coming into Japan.
Ah, okay.
And so I wanted to be able to have the contrast of a ninja detective, but also to have a pair of Western eyes who could be a focal lens for the Western reader who maybe didn't know much about Japan and would let me really explore the culture. Absolutely.
I was thinking about the story you told me at church, how this all came to be. And I don't want the interview to be over before we had a chance to talk about that. How in the world did this whole world come to be? How did you choose this particular person and all of the characters? It started really with a word from the Lord, didn't it?
You know, it really kind of did. I have always felt a calling to be a writer. And to be just a writer that you'd find in the Barnes & Noble or just a writer.
Right. Not necessarily designated a Christian writer, but rather you're a writer who is a Christian.
I agree with C.S. Lewis on this point, which is that the best thing that a Christian writer can do, or the best thing that a Christian can do, is just write a good book.
Oh, I love that.
And so I had written 4 other manuscripts, and they were historical fiction, various characters. And I had been trying to break in. And when you're trying to break in publishing, typically what you do is you write a manuscript and then you query agents. And then when an agent signs you, you have that agent send the manuscript off to publishers.
Which is immediate and enthusiastic, right?
The first
time you send something off?
Oh, absolutely. Without question. Yes, they just beat down your door, as anyone out there who's written a novel can tell you, I'm sure.
I just snorted it.
Yes. I had been working on this for 10 years, actually.
Wow.
I started really taking my writing seriously in 2002, and I signed with my agent in 2012. So that should tell you something.
Wow. So the impetus of the person's name, your hero, as it were?
Yes. Well, my ninja's name is Hiro Hattori, and I was standing in front of the bathroom mirror one morning, getting ready for work and thinking, okay, you know, what should I write about? And I was being prayerful about it and saying, you know, what should I be writing about? I know there's something out there I'm meant to do. What is it? And as I was standing there putting on eyeliner, a voice, as if someone else were in the room with me, though no one was, mm-hmm. said, "Most ninjas commit murders, but Hiro Hattori solves them."
Wow. What a great tagline that is.
Yeah, and the name and everything.
And his name is Hiro, H-I-R-O, but it sounds so much like the Western word hero, which I also love.
And you know, I did think about that a little bit. I went to my husband and my son and I said, "Is that too cheesy? Is that too cliche?" And they both said, "No, it's great," because Hiro actually is a period appropriate Japanese name.
Sure.
So I sat down, I thought, well, okay, and went into my writing room and discovered I actually already had all the research books because my undergraduate degree was in Asian studies, Japanese history and culture. And I thought, well, I've already got the books. Let's see what we can do with this. And realized almost at once that he needed to be working with a priest.
Why is that? Why did that come to you?
Well, there were a couple of factors. First of all, ninjas were usually spies. They worked undercover. And so...
Were they mercenaries? Were they guns for hire, as it were? Swords for hire?
Yes, they really were. So I needed some excuse for him to have to solve these murders, because normally he wouldn't do that.
Okay.
And solving murders was not a thing. There was a police force in Kyoto, but there weren't all that many investigations, because this was a time when people's heads left their bodies on a regular basis.
Right. Not unlike 16th century England, by the way.
Very true. So I decided, well, I need an excuse to get him into the city and in a place where he could solve murders, but that still didn't explain why he would solve them. And so I needed someone with the kind of empathy to be able to say, this is an injustice that needs to be corrected.
Mm.
And I also knew that most of my readers probably would not understand much about 16th century Japan. People have seen Shogun, maybe, you know, or they have an idea. But I thought a priest is a very good focal lens for the culture, for needing to get these murders solved, and also someone who has a worldview that's very opposed to Hiro's own. Because my protagonist, Hiro, is actually more of an agnostic. He is, as he puts it, too busy staying alive in this world to worry about the next one.
Ah, I see. So the book that I just read, and it's the first book in the series, is called Claws of the Cat. By the way, you can pick that up at Amazon.com. It's published by Minotaur Books, which is an imprint of Macmillan, I believe.
That's correct.
Okay.
St. Martin's Press, yes.
So people can just pop over to Amazon and look for Claws of the Cat by Susan Spann. And just introduce us a little bit to the world in general, and then I'd love to talk with you a little more about this priest character. So what's Claws of the Cat about?
Well, the tagline I usually give people about the book is that when a samurai is murdered in a Kyoto tea house, a master ninja and a Jesuit priest have just 3 days to find the killer, to save the life of the beautiful teenage geisha accused of the crime, and also the life of the priest that the ninja has pledged his own life to protect.
Wow. So there's a timeline there. They're working on a very strict timeline, and they have to solve this murder together. And they have to do it together because the ninja has pledged to protect the priest. Do I have it right?
That's correct.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about the world. Introduce us to the world. What's it look like and smell like and feel like? What's it like to be in Kyoto in 16th century?
It was a very vibrant time and a very dangerous time. If I say, imagine a samurai and you think of a man in armor with a sword.
Mm-hmm.
Those people really existed in that time, and the samurai were the nobles. But there were really four social classes that all interacted together in Kyoto in this time. There were noblemen,
okay,
samurai, and that was men and women. And
women could be samurai.
Yes, samurai was actually more like being born a noble in Britain. If you were of the samurai class, that was determined by your birth. And as far as being a warrior, mostly it was the men who were warriors. But there was a term, onnabugeisha, which meant a female samurai warrior.
Okay, all right.
And if a man had no sons, he was legally permitted to raise his daughter as a warrior. And one of these female warriors actually appears in the book.
Yeah, I was going to say there is one of those characters in the book.
I thought that was such an interesting facet of the culture that I really wanted to bring it in. And in fact, each book in the series will examine a different part of this culture to really give a sense of that vibrance. So you had the samurai, and then beneath them were actually technically the farmers. Beneath the farmers were the merchants, and then beneath the merchants were an untouchable class, and also the entertainers, which might have included the geisha, and also singers, actors, dancers, things like that.
At the very bottom.
Right.
So this Jesuit priest and the samurai who has been sworn to protect him are out to solve a murder, and they get to by virtue of their social classes or their station in life, are able to penetrate lots of different of these social classes and go to different places. Tell us a little bit about the places that they go, including there's a temple, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, or a temple complex.
There is a temple. The murder actually takes place in a tea house, mm-hmm. or what we would now call a geisha house. I use the term geisha, although at the time, the term geisha actually came into use in the 1700s. And so in the book, I actually simply use the word entertainer.
Mm.
The word geisha technically translates artist. Mm. And so entertainer was the precursor word. And so the woman who is accused of murdering her samurai patron is a young geisha in her teens who has recently become a convert of Father Mateo's. Convert to Christianity.
And Father Mateo is the Jesuit priest we're talking about.
Yes, sorry about that. Hiro is the ninja and his Jesuit friend is Father Mateo.
Okay.
And Hiro thinks that it's a little too convenient that this young girl who's just become a convert a week ago, so to speak, is now accused of murder and asking for the priest's help.
Mm.
Father Mateo, on the other hand, believes that the girl has actually been wrongfully accused and that they need to help her. And so the book has some tension in it as the two of them work out those competing views of mm-hmm. what might be going on.
By the way, it struck me that both of those characters are bold in their own way. The samurai is bold in sort of all the obvious samurai kinds of ways, but Father Mateo is very bold as well in his own quiet but firm way, don't you think?
He really is. In fact, he started out in my mind before I wrote the series as being what I would call a true Watson, a much lesser character in comparison to Hiro, really more of a foil.
Mm-hmm.
And as I wrote the first draft, I very quickly came to realize that Father Mateo is just as strong and just as important to the series as Hiro, and they really are a partnership and a team. And Father Mateo is he's very bold. He's a quiet man, but he has very firm convictions. He has a great love and a very strong faith and a love for all of the people of Japan. And when they do go to the temple and to this geisha house and to actually a house of ill repute, which mm-hmm. they visit because they need to find out about what's gone on with a girl who may have been sold there, Father Mateo is the one who consistently humanizes people that Japanese culture refused to recognize.
Ah, that's a really interesting point. So there's another good reason to have Father Mateo in the story, because he can open our eyes up to a world that otherwise would have been closed to us if we were looking through a Japanese lens.
I think so, and I think even a lens that maybe to this day we sometimes don't see, because Father Mateo looks at every human and sees a life that is worthy of having value and having love. And he does that regardless of social status, of cleanliness, of wealth. And he opens Hiro's eyes a little bit, although they do have some tension over this from mm-hmm. time to time.
Oh, what you've just said is a timeless message, that we should be looking at others through the eyes of Christ, of love, of their own worth, no matter their social class or status. You've chosen a Jesuit priest. I want to touch on that just a little bit, if we can. You said that it was sort of the rise, within a generation or so, of the Jesuit order being founded, but they are present in Japan. Any other particular reasons you wanted your detective sidekick to be a Jesuit?
Well, I think, first of all, the Jesuits were the only priests in Japan at that time.
Oh,
so,
I see.
So if you wanted it to be a priest, it pretty much had to be a Jesuit.
I see. So no other Roman Catholic orders or no other presence of priests other than Jesuits?
Not at that point. Later on, yes, but not early on. I could have made him, of course, I could have made him a merchant, and there is a weapons dealing merchant in the book who is a piece of work.
It's a funny character. I love him.
I could have chosen a later time period for the books and still made it work if I had wanted a different type of priest. I specifically wanted a Jesuit.
Okay, tell us why.
I wanted a Jesuit because in the short quip that a friend of mine once said to me, they're the rock stars of the Catholic world.
especially now, right?
Yes, exactly. The Jesuits had a great deal of freedom as compared to other priests of their time. And what I mean by that is that the Jesuits very often accepted ministries in places that were not open to the West, in China and throughout Asia and in Japan. And so they tended to be much more independent. they tended to be people who had very strong dedication to their faith, which of course you would have had to have if you were going to be dropped. I mean, you can think about how difficult it is to pursue faith right now in the modern world, surrounded by all of the opportunities for people of faith that exist.
Sure.
All of the churches, all of the books, all of the Bible studies. These men were dropped into a foreign country.
Yeah, like another planet.
With a Bible in their own language, and if they were lucky, either a translator or a dictionary. But in many cases, they were dropped in and told, write the dictionary,
right.
Translate the Bible, and get the message across to this culture. And so they were real pioneers in some ways in terms of being people who had to live their faith against sometimes remarkable odds.
They were in some ways, especially the Jesuit orders, especially suited to that particular job.
I think they were, because the order was founded by Father Francis Xavier, and one of his fundamental tenets was the idea that when you go into a new culture, you differ only on fundamental points of doctrine. And so
the essentials.
Right, the essentials. And so you hold the line and you speak the truth, but you do it in a way that does not alienate. One of the problems the Spanish Catholics had in many of the countries they went into, and one of the reasons that the conquistadors ended up simply conquering native peoples, was that the rule for much of this, and you know, I hate generalizations, but the way that the Catholic Church operated in many of the countries that it went into was to take over and require people to become Roman Catholics.
Yeah, assimilate.
Yes. And that didn't just mean going to church and to confession, it meant changing the way they were living their daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very difficult for people. I mean, if you can imagine someone coming into your life and saying, it's very nice that you've done all of these things, and this is your job, and that's what you do and believe, and what you eat, and the way you talk, but now you're going to start worshiping only in Latin, and you're going to start reading the Bible in Latin, and learning this other new language, and changing the way you dress, and changing the way you eat, and changing the way you marry and talk. And that's very difficult to accept, particularly in Asia, where people were polytheistic. They were very family oriented, and in many cases, family involved more than one wife. Not so much in Japan, although that did exist, but especially in China and other places. And so for the Jesuits to come in and say, we want to talk with you about Jesus. We want to talk with you about the Creator God. I mentioned to you the other day, it reminds me a little bit of Paul at Mars Hill, you know, and when Paul said, you know, you worship what you do not know. Let me tell you about what it is that you actually, you know, let me tell you about this God that you call to an unknown God who created the universe. And so the Jesuits could come in and say, let me tell you about who really created the world.
Wow. A good lesson even for now.
Absolutely. I think that one of the things Jesuits did not do was beat people over the head with Bibles.
You're listening to Ancient Future Faith. It's a weekly radio program. I'm Chris Alford, the host and also the pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community right here in Sacramento. You can learn more about ancient future faith by popping over to the website. It's epiclesis.org, E-P-I-C-L-E-S-I-S. Today, my guest is author and lawyer and church member and mom, Susan Spann. She has written a wonderful series of mysteries called the Shinobi Mysteries. I just finished the wonderful first book called The Claws of the Cat. You can find it at Amazon.com. And I'm interviewing Susan today and talking with her about, well, gosh, a lot of things. 16th century Japan, what happens when a samurai detective teams up with a Jesuit priest sidekick. But one of the things I wanted to do, Susan, before the time gets away from us, is to talk with you a little bit about this business of ancient future faith. I tend to always ask our guests what in the world they think ancient future Christian faith is all about. But I thought it would be particularly interesting to ask you where you see ancient future Christian faith principles intersecting with this amazing world that you've created for your readers in the Shinobi Mysteries.
Well, I think that one of the things that's most attractive to me about the idea of ancient future faith is the idea that we have a connection which goes backward in time as well as forward. And very often we as people and as Christians think about our legacy. And legacy is a forward-looking concept. But the idea of ancient future is that we're not actually the end. we are the middle. And we're part of an unbroken chain that goes all the way back. And one of the things that I think is really wonderful about ancient future principles is that, like the Jesuits working in Japan, they felt a really strong tie to the origins of the church. They felt a very strong tie to what were the fundamental principles of the faith that they were trying to carry out. And I think those fundamental principles transcend time. I think there are ideas, and obviously they do, they're the tenets of a faith, and a faith cannot survive for thousands of years if it doesn't have some central positions.
For sure.
And I think that there are truths that Father Mateo speaks in the books, which resonate, as you mentioned, they're a resonating message for us even today.
Yeah.
And I think that's because they are ancient future principles. They are truths that exist, that are embedded in our hearts as well as in our faith.
Simone Weil, the author and essayist and poet, I believe, philosopher, once said that in order to always be relevant, you must say things that are eternal. It strikes me that Father Mateo is doing that very thing in your books. What are some of those truths that he speaks?
I think the idea that God's welcome to people is equal and eternal to all people, that the invitation is open to everyone, and it doesn't matter when or where or how you were born. And that's a big message in this first book.
Oh, you're talking about the claws of the cat.
Yes, because Hiro, the ninja's position, he's also a samurai as well as a ninja, his position is that society has rules and people have places and everyone needs to be in his place. But for Father Mateo to say in public that an entertainer's life is worth just as much as that of a samurai was revolutionary in Japan.
Mm.
But it is a universal truth that every life is valuable and unique and loved by God. And that is a message that I think is really important for Father Mateo and is very important for me also. Father Mateo does not have a divisive faith. And what I mean by that is that, unfortunately, in the modern age, it is common and sad, in my opinion, to see Christians from different branches or sects or parts of Christianity to turn on one another and say, well, we're the real Christians. You're not Christians. Yeah. You're not really, we don't really like those guys. And I'm very fond of saying, we all play for the same team, and it's not a big enough team to fight amongst ourselves.
Wow. I'm talking today to author Susan Spann. She is the author of a series of books in the Shinobi Mystery series. Her first book, Claws of the Cat, is published by Minotaur Press and available at Amazon.com. Susan, is the next book ready yet? I can't wait.
The next book is actually releasing on July 15th.
Oh, it coming up soon. And the name?
The name is Blade of the Samurai.
Another mystery?
It is another mystery. It is another mystery in the Hiro and Father Mateo series.
Okay, so we get to see them again at work. Hey, Susan, I think you have a website. If people wanted to learn more about you or about your books, let's make sure we mention that before we go.
Absolutely. It is susanspann.com. And so that's S-U-S-A-N, S, P as in Peter, A, N is in Nancy, N is in Nancy.com.
So two N's at the end,
SusanSpann.com.
Yes. Hey, it's been wonderful having you here today. I want you to come back because we didn't even get on the lawyer stuff, and I wanted to talk to you about your life as a lawyer who is also a Christian. I'm fascinated by the work that you do.
Well, I'd love to. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Folks, you can learn more about Susan by popping over to her website. She mentioned the site. You can also learn more about Epiclesis by coming to our website. But my guest today has been author and mom and lawyer and church member Susan Spann, and you've got to pick up a copy of this book. Folks, until we gather next time for another edition of Ancient Future Faith, I want you to remember this, really ponder it, that the road to our evangelical future certainly does run through our ancient Christian past. The Lord be with you.
Thank you for joining us for another look at Ancient Future Faith. There is a refreshing wind of renewal blowing through the evangelical church as more and more worshipers turn for inspiration to the rich language and pattern of the ancient church, and they're rediscovering classic Christianity and learning to draw strength from a deep well of time-tested truth and tradition. Want to experience ancient future faith for yourself? Join us for worship at Epiclesis in Sacramento on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. in the chapel at 4600 Winding Way. You can contact us by calling 916-572-9113 or online at epiclesis.org. That's 916-572-9113 or on the web at epiclesis.org.
Hi there, folks. Pastor Chris here with a little note to say that we're right in the middle of one of the best times of the whole Christian year, the celebration of Easter. In the ancient church, Easter was a season of rejoicing, not just a day, and the Easter season is a great opportunity to see what ancient future Christian worship at Epiclesis looks like. Find more information on the web at epiclesis.org. That's epiclesis.org. The Lord be with you, and see you next Saturday at 1 p.m. for another edition of Ancient Future Faith.